Listen, ma'am, can you disconnect and then try again? It's all... Ma'am, is this an emergency?
A 32 Fans podcast where we discuss all things movies, past, present, and occasionally future. My name is Sammy Chester, and this episode will not only be about movies that came out in May 2020, including our feature, The Vast of Night, but we also have a bonus track that decides the best movies ever made about hindsight, since, as we know, hindsight is 2020. Before I introduce our guests, I want to quickly note perhaps the obvious. Things are so crazy right now in the, you know, in the real world, particularly in the U.S. We can certainly understand if, as my two regular co-hosts, you're not quite locked into movies right now. You're not quite locked into seeing movies. You're not quite locked into talking about movies or listening to movies. You know, we won't be insulted. We'd be surprised, actually, if you only, you know, maybe get to this episode a bit later than when we're recording it now at the end of May 2020. But at the same time, you are still following up with movies. That's also fine because, you know, I think everyone reacts to these times differently. And, you know, we touch upon different needs. You know, everyone is, I think, interacting with some of the civic unrest, the racial tensions, obviously the mass pandemic, the impact on employment. Some of that might spill over into our discussion of movies. With that said, let me introduce the two stellar guests that are replacing my regular co-hosts, Will from America and Av, the King of Podcasts, who are both on absentee leave. Justin Patridge, Aaron Brooks, both have resumes so impressive. I will leave them to introduce themselves. Aaron, maybe if you can go first, what would you say makes you a credible movie commentator? And why are listeners excused if they want to discount anything you have to say?
They absolutely are excused right away from anything I'm about to say. I believe that movies are an extremely personal experience. And so with that, I bring my personal views to it. I don't really care about consensus or going against consensus, but I just really believe that you only bring your own life experiences into a movie. Why they should maybe take my credibility. I don't put limits on what I'm willing to see. There's not a genre that I would say is my favorite or least favorite. I don't care if the cast looks like me, doesn't look like me, if I can relate to them or not relate to them, that is pretty irrelevant to me. So my lack of limits, I think, should add some credibility to the listeners out there.
Loyal listeners probably know, Aaron is most famous in the Worldly Pod universe as the movie expert cited by superfan Zach. Maybe Aaron will bring up why Zach Brooks often brings up Aaron Brooks as his reference point for movies.
So I'm honored to have that added to the resume there.
Zach, who's been on our pod, I think, three times, and he's such a loyal listener, he spun off and made a breakaway pod with, super host of, also about movies, the Movie Ladder pod. Yeah. For the last year, Zach will frequently introduce when wanting to reference his justification for a movie. Well, he goes, well, my brother Aaron, the movie expert.
Oh my God. So. That sounds like a great movie, first of all. And that is beautiful. And just real quick, this legacy goes all the way back to Jimmy John's sub shop at age 14, where I was Zach's little brother who got a job there. And I was known as LB Little Brooks until I was 21 and got fired from there. So this is a deep rooted, my brother's the reason I made it onto this podcast. He's my reference, if you will. So
okay. See, I don't know if either of you guys know this, but when I was a kid, you know how they used to have books in the library that were sort of on display at the entrance? The book in my elementary school library in Minnesota where I grew up was a preteen book about the Revolutionary War. And the name of the book was called My Brother Sam is Dead.
Oh my God.
I remember this book.
Yeah, it's a real book. Okay, great. Yeah, Aaron, yes, I was always sure whether I was imagining it because no one else ever read it. No one else ever
came off the shelf. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I read it.
Or like, they have a horrified reaction like I just did when you tell them the title of the book.
I actually do legitimately remember it. Must be a Midwestern classic. I grew up
in
Michigan.
Amazing.
It is such an intimidating title. The book is actually not that scary. I mean, the book is about a soldier in the Revolutionary War whose older brother, Ala the Patriot, is sort of killed early on, I think. And that sort of motivates him to fight the British and defend the U.S. But it's a pretty horrifying title if your name is Sam. And I remember
that's very standoffish as a opening line.
I think that's the opening line of the book also. I remember reading the book.
Oh my God.
I think I've read the book in like in the bathroom in elementary school, like huddled up in fear, you know. I thought it was coming for me. Justin, listeners may recall that you joined us to discuss one of my favorite movies. I think, again, the legacy movie of the past year, Uncut Gems. About 5 months ago. Is there any reason listeners should trust you now? Let's say if we're going to be talking about a sci-fi throwback about alien abduction. Do you have any background on those subjects?
Well, Mr. How Much Time You Got? Just kind of been a dork forever. Here recently, my main base is at Newsarama. I also am a columnist and critic for Rogues Portal. And there's a new upstart horror website called Dismember that I'm co-editing with my buddy Ishna. Shout out Ishna. I'm kind of the same. I don't really try to hem myself into genres. I much prefer genre stuff. Most of my main beats are kind of horror and science fiction and pulpy stuff.
If we stumble across a movie about flying saucers set in like the Deep South, potentially even filmed in Texas, that might be right up your alley.
You stop drilling, you hit oil. Like, you don't even have to...
I'm excited for our feature, but let's discuss a few what we like to call recent watches on the way there. Aaron, maybe you can go first. What are a few new movies you saw in May? Again, these would be movies that came out in 2020, and given theaters have been shut down now for, what is it, almost 3 months, everything would be streaming. So whether it came out in May, whether it came out earlier this year, and you only caught up to it in the last 30 days, what do you suggest people check out or make sure they avoid?
I'll do the sandwich thing that always seems to happen to me in job interviews when I used to have those before I worked for myself. So I'll start with one of my good ones. You know, it's the compliment sandwich. I'm kind of a hopeless romantic at heart. I always have been. It was The Half of It, directed by Alice Wu. A little bit all too relatable for my early dating life, maybe. It's just really about really trying to conform your identity to the person you're obsessing about. And then, like, what is love? All those questions that will make you roll your eyes, they're all in this movie. And it's about introverted high school girl who is helping the jock try to get the girl, basically. And there was a Vince Vendor reference early on, and Vince Vendor happens to be one of my favorite filmmakers of all time. I was sold.
That was kind of the first half of May, the big Netflix release. I checked out the trailer, but I ended up skipping it. To me, the concern, as you had said, was that there's a whole subgenre, talk about genre, of Netflix teenage rom-com, or not even com, but just rom.
Especially in the last few years, I've really cornered that market, weirdly enough.
The guy who plays Paul, Daniel Dimer, he was harsh. He was harsh to deal with, I'll be honest. I found Leia Lewis and Alexis Lemire. I'm hoping I'm saying their names right. Ellie and Aster. I thought they were both fantastic. There's an LGBTQT angle in it that I thought was handled respectfully and not done to pander. I'm very sensitive to pandering too. I felt it was organically in the movie and added a unique dimension to the overall love triangle, if you will.
It's a movie I want to bring up soon as well, also about teenage romance. Even as it's covered so much, I think it hasn't been covered until the last 5+ years in a more complex way, whether that's bringing in, you know, LGBT desires and relationships into it, whether that's having more of a female gaze, or whether that's sort of showing more, I guess, the complexity fact that, you know, when we say all's fair in love, it's really true. I mean, you know, you kind of do crazy things in teenage romantic triangles. Crazy meaning, I think, in an authentic sort of my heart is breaking in a million pieces way. I think more movies coming out that really embrace authentic pain and that complexity and that showing from different perspectives, different ethnic backgrounds. All that, I think, is super helpful into the culture at large.
And it uses text messaging really well. Movies really botch that a lot.
They absolutely do.
And this movie actually uses it really, really great throughout. And if you like a little cheese, which I think right now, it just felt a little good to have a little cheese this afternoon as we had a 7 p.m. curfew here in Washington, D.C. So, you know, sappy rom-com. And it does rip off, particularly at the beginning, if you've seen 500 Days of Summer.
Okay, let me piggyback quickly, because a movie that was on my probably a soft recommend, about the same maybe kick you're giving, would be another summer romance, another teenage romance, Premature. It almost plays out at some points in the movie like a horror movie. And that's because it's incredibly real. So it doesn't have any of the pixie dust maybe of the half of it. What Premature is about is it's a summer romance between a recent graduate in Harlem, a young African-American girl, and sort of a 22, 23-year-old, slightly older African-American guy who she meets, and they have a fling. It's about the rise and fall and destruction of a relationship. Every expectation that you may have coming in happens. Yes, she gets pregnant. Yes, she has to have a painful, like in her apartment, incredibly bloody kind of at-home abortion, you know, early on. But, you know, so all those things happen, and that's why there's a lot of pain in this. And it's not, again, not a pixie dust teenage romance whatsoever. The one thing I have to share about Premature, and hear me out, because this isn't as, you know, teenage sex crazed as you're going to think from what I'm about to say. The movie has three sex scenes in them, and I felt they were very powerful in how they told the entire narrative, in that the first sex scene is erotic and curious, and there's a hesitation that is clearly, you know, driving the way it's filmed and the way the actors are. The second sex scene, there's sort of a comfort, which I think, again, suggests where a relationship can be like a month or so into it, or a few months in this case. And then the very last one is what really got me in. And this, to me, when you said how, you know, the half of it sort of spoke to some of your teenage own memories, in that, and not, this didn't necessarily happen to me when I was a teenager by any means, the very last sex scene is angry and empty and distant, and the couple is basically in the process of breaking up, and if they kind of still hook up. Suffice to say, we don't have to get into this, the three of us, you know, any more detail than I'm bringing up.
Something don't? Great.
There was something very real and something very authentic about that, that I don't feel particularly, at least with a teenage romance, right, I've ever seen portrayed, which is the way in which, where it's over and it's done and you're angry at each other, you see that literally in their physical action and in their faces. And, you know, yes, they're like making love, so to speak. But I don't know, just that final sex scene to me was, it captured the whole arc of sort of the relationship. So if having, you know, overly perhaps intellectual, emotional reaction to two actors having sex does it for you in the way I just described, then check out Premature. But otherwise,
I'm sold, Sammy.
Half of it, Premature.
But Aaron, which one did you hate?
If you follow me on Letterboxd or go to my Letterboxd, for the most part, I'm above 3 stars on most movies. I really can find like the good, and I like, and I admire the overall movie making.
I'm famously at work too. I'm the guy that loves everything. So like, yeah, they'll pitch me anything, and they're like, oh yeah, Justin loves it just because it's something.
This movie got a whole 2 stars, so I really didn't like it.
Oh,
I know, under 2.5. And I haven't seen the original. Apparently, it was a remake of an 80s movie, and it was Valley Girl. Rachel Goldenberg.
And yes,
I've watched a decent amount of jukebox musicals. You usually know by the first beat of the first song if it's missing that special something that makes it like theatrical or kind of VOD. I knew right away this was a VOD musical. It just was missing something. I was hearing songs I loved and not enjoying it that much.
Right. And this just, is the lead is
Jessica Rauch.
Yes.
Who I love. I love Happy Death Day and Happy Death Day.
She's tremendous in Happy Death Day 1 too. Yeah. I mean, Happy Death Day in general are just amazing. They're both amazing.
Yeah, the second one I love. I think it's one of the best movies of that year, honestly. It was so good. But she is just completely wasted in this. She's paired up with Josh Whitehouse, who I don't know anything about. His most notable thing was
You said that name and just white noise just passed over
he
my
looks,
eyes.
He looks
no
like,
idea.
He looks like Dollar Store Evan Peters. he acts like half dollar.
The original Valley Girl is amazing, by the way. If you get a chance to see it, please see it because it's amazing. It's very charming and sweet.
And I'm not a sound guy or even like a huge musical guy, but I just knew right away I felt like a YouTube video.
Aaron, you claimed at the top that you're not a genre guy whatsoever. Well, you know, Justin came clear a bit more, but it sounds like you pigeonholed yourself as the teenage rom-com guy or the teenage romance guy. That's your sweet spot. Yeah.
I mean, apparently, for one, during this whole quarantine, I've watched more movies than ever before. I've found movies to be an incredible refuge, but my favorite spot has been the Criterion Channel. So not too many teen rom-coms over there, but...
But Valley Girl, the half of it?
The pickings are slim right now, Sam. I don't know if you know, but theaters aren't operating right now.
Oh my God, Sam, do you know? Yeah. Sit down, buddy.
Boy, hey, I have a story for you.
Please finish on an up note, and then I'll bring it back down.
Okay, yeah. So, and this was my favorite new movie I saw of this month. And I would consider this a movie that I think was a favorite in a lot of months. And it's Brandon Cronenberg's second movie, and it is Possessor. Like seeing David Cronenberg's Spawn make a movie. That's how I would describe it. I did not know that he had made another movie. Yeah.
I loved Antiviral. Antiviral is amazing.
I really liked Antiviral. I like this more. There are some amazing practical effects in this with like melting wax figures and just all the Cronenberg greatness of body horror that you kind of know and he's been pigeonholed into. Like, it is just like, it really sometimes talent just is genetic. Goes for it. It's weird. There's been some people who have accused of being violent for violence sake. I think the violence is warranted in the movie and not just empty calories, but I can see that being some people's criticisms. But the lead was from one of my favorite Black Mirror episodes, which a lot of people also don't like, which is White Crocodile, I believe, was the episode, the one where she ends up covering up a drunk driver.
Yes, I think it's just called Crocodile, the Scottish lady.
Yes,
Scottish or Irish?
I believe she's Scottish. Her name's Andrea Riseborough.
Yes,
Andrea Riseborough. Yeah. She has the mannerisms made for like horror movie.
She's like an assassin who transports into other people's like bodies and takes them over to assassinate high influential targets. It's like a little bit Blade Runner. A little bit really, really cool, unique sci-fi.
Yeah, it is a horror movie. So I think that's one genre that I will, you know, certainly raise my hand. I'm like a non-horror movies are the one genre I sort of stay away from because it just doesn't do it for me. Andrea, the actress, was in two stellar 2018 movies that have almost the same name, Mandy and Nancy. I loved Nancy. I love
Mandy.
Nancy.
That's where she. I was like, she's pinging for something else too.
So gotta think she filmed Mandy and this movie close together and just was on a wild little.
Can you imagine?
These two back to back would be very different. Very different shades of the same side of the coin. There's a great Sean Bean role in this movie. So anytime you get Sean Bean. Jennifer Jason Leigh has carved out this weird niche as like crazy lady who leads people in. She's like playing a role from Annihilation, but a little bit better and wonkier. So like she doesn't say the title of the movie in this, like she does in Annihilation.
Oh man, I love that. I always point to my wife and I'm like, that's the Annihilation.
She doesn't go Possessor in this movie. She's like that same wild lady in this. Christopher Abbott, which I haven't seen him in a ton of stuff. So like, yeah, it's got a great cast. I loved watching the interviews afterwards with Brandon Cronenberg, and he's about the art, and he's maybe some call pretentious. I don't buy that when it comes to film. He really cares about what he's doing out there. So it's got 93% of Rotten Tomatoes, so I guess people like it.
Justin, how about you? Give us a few hits and misses.
One thing in particular that's starting to hit wider that I'm very happy about. It got picked up by Fangoria. I got to see it at the end of last year as part of my coverage for Dismember for the Brooklyn Horror Film Festival. And it's a movie called Porno. Now, Hold on for a second. It's a lot sweeter and a lot funnier than it sounds. If Mario Barva, right after he had made Demons, made Saved, it would be Porno.
Oh, wow.
It's a horror comedy that's actually funny for once. Set in like, I think 1994 or 1993. there's a Christian run movie house that only plays two movies. It's like Encino Man and something else. And the crew of the theater get to stay late, and they're going to watch a movie. So they're going to watch Encino Man. But before they can find a haunted blue movie, so they play it, and it releases a succubus onto this Christian movie theater. And it's hysterical. It's so funny. It has like it has genuinely like fun character-based gags. Like even before all the horror stuff starts, it really takes its time to let you get to know these people, get to know their dynamic, their like their weird power structure that they have. And then it just starts throwing blood everywhere. It's so fun. I had an absolute blast with it. Fangoria just here recently picked it up, but if you can see it, God, please do, because it's so fun. It's kind of gross. Obviously, there was a big hubbub here recently in Fangoria, where they had done a pictorial on some of the practical effects, and it caused their first big run of people writing in to say, oh, this is too disgusting. I'm canceling my Fangoria magazine subscription because it's too gross. You can't show stuff like this in a magazine.
My problem is that I can admit bleakly that I'm someone who gets my movies from a different source. And the source in which I download my movies, if you type in the movie title porno, you're
absolutely
never,
it's going to be impossible. It's just, it's a needle in a haystack.
I am never going to find a movie that is a horror comedy. So
it's even funny you're trying to put a date at the end of it, like porno 2020. And it's just like, what?
Yeah, so I gave up because I don't want to infect my computer too much. Porno was not happening for me, but hey, if the brave listener, whether on French Netflix, as we call it, or elsewhere, can find a way of watching porno, you know, then between that and between my recommendation for the sex scenes in Premature, I think, you know, you'll have a...
Oh yeah, we're back in the thousands, Sammy. This is going to be an all-timer.
It'll be a scintillating recent watches for sure.
My next one is a little bit more popular. Guy Ritchie's new movie, The Gentleman, which I found quite delightful after having largely written Ritchie off. I'm one of, like, I guess the 12 people that love his King Arthur movie. It's 13 now.
Me too. 14.
Oh, 14. Oh, my God. It's going to be the greatest episode ever.
Yeah. I really like Guy Ritchie also. I'm not ashamed to admit it.
We had a past episode where we cited our biggest bombs, movies that like wasted the most Hollywood money, and it had to be your favorite biggest bomb. And my favorite biggest bomb was Guy Ritchie's King Arthur. I just find it.
I mean, that's a really good bet, man.
Yeah. It is like
wasted a lot of money.
It's an incredibly fun bad movie.
That's why I think Charlie Hunnam was perfect for it.
Film editor's dream, because they know they
absolutely.
They could take apart that 1 movie.
1,000,000%.
They could take apart the movie and make such a better one. But yeah, I'm on board for Guy Ritchie in general just because he has such a sense of style.
Yeah, absolutely. And he gets a lot of really fun stuff out of actors. And I think The Gentleman here recently is a really, really great example of how when he just focuses with actors. My buddy Stefano on Twitter, shout out Stefano, you're a genius. They had an amazing read on the movie, which is that this is clearly Ritchie making a movie about his own career as someone who started as an indie guy, got really huge, kind of flamed out, became sort of a system guy, and now wants to see if he has teeth again, which is precisely the arc of Matthew McConaughey's character in that entire movie. So going into it with that, I was just completely engaged with it.
Yeah, I'm surprised I didn't make more of an impact. People love McConaughey. Guy Ritchie, I think, still has a certain loyal following. And, you know, the cast of The Gentleman is all over the place. I missed it so I think I'll take your recommendation.
It's going to be this year's...
Uncut Gems.
Oh, God, no. Jesus, no. I don't want to swing that far, Sam. I'm trying to think of what was the Revolver. I think it's going to be this year's Revolver. Like, people will go back to Revolver and be like, oh, this is actually pretty good. I think people will come back to The Gentleman eventually and say that it's good. My last one was just kind of a pitch up, Underwater. I thought Underwater was really fun. It was really mean. I think it's a kind of a novel way to kind of do the Aliens movies again. And TJ Miller got a particularly gnarly death. So two thumbs up from Justin. Justin says, check it out, Underwater.
That was a way to kind of insult a movie to the extent Justin can by mentioning a TJ Miller death scene. There was a lot of movies that fell into my, not really a must, but okay. That was most of the movies I saw this month that fell into that, meaning things I liked, but not things I would say are must watches. But the one movie I would recommend to anyone who listens to this podcast, I think, would be The Trip to Greece. Now, I had never heard of any of the Trip movies. What this is the fourth and the titular last of the Trip movies. What the Trip movies are is for the last like 13 years, I think, an English director has been making a series of movies about two British comedians, Steve Coogan, Rob Brydon, as they go around different parts of Europe in each movie, eating at fancy restaurants. Presumably they're there. They're playing themselves, but sort of an exaggerated version. Presumably they're on these jaunts as to write a restaurant review, but they don't do anything with restaurants. It's not a, you know, if you don't food in restaurants, it's irrelevant. Essentially what the movies are is they're a movie podcast mashed up with exotic footage of beautiful landscapes. And then it's
1,000,000%. Yeah,
and then
you've nailed it.
And when I say it's a movie podcast hosted by two really funny British comedians. And if that sounds like your cup of tea, to use sort of the obvious necessary Britishism, then you have four, arguably five, as I'll get to later, maybe, movies to enjoy. Because again, you know, they've made a bunch of these. They say this is their last one. I sat down and watched all four of them, starting with the first one, The Trip, which is set in Northern England. It's probably the best of them, only because the movies are very much serialized. They were based on a TV show.
Yes.
Each movie is the same as the one before.
Do you know anything about Steve Coogan at all, like Alan Partridge or stuff like that?
Okay, so I did not know Alan Partridge or Rob Brydon's The Man in the Little Box. What I do know, and which one of the reasons I particularly enjoyed The Trip to Greece, which I finally got to after force-feeding myself all the trips in 1 week, was that I loved the Laurel Hardy movie that came out in the very end of 2018, in which
With John C. Reilly.
Yeah, John C. Reilly and Steve Coogan. I thought Steve Coogan was incredible in that movie. I really liked the movie. It was one of my favorite kind of overlooked movies of the year. And
Coogan's one of those comedy guys that when he gets a good director or if he gets a really particularly juicy script, he can really get, like, he's amazing at 24-Hour Party People, if you've ever seen that. There's another movie here recently, I think it's called like Filthy Rich or something like that. He plays a real life like British Bernie Madoff, basically.
I think it's called Greed.
He's great.
I think it's called
Greed. Greed, that's what it is. Yeah.
Anyone listening to this podcast, try the first one, try The Trip. If listening to these two British guys make fun of every other British actor of note, particularly Michael Caine, you know, Christian Bale, whoever, Tom Hardy, If that's your jam, and if they're impersonations and they're...
Yeah, that's another thing. Coogan is an incredible impressionist. It's almost uncanny.
Oh, I think Brydon's great as well.
Brydon is too, yeah, absolutely. But it's like a Coogan, because I'm a huge Alan Partridge fan. And just like the specificity of that guy's humor and the sharpness of it is just, it's masterful.
I think anyone over 40 who amuses themselves by doing impressions needs to take a long, hard look in the mirror.
Well, broadsheet journalists have described my impressions as stunningly accurate.
Well, they're wrong. I've not heard your Michael Caine, but I assume it would be something along the lines of, my name's Michael Caine.
That is where you are so wrong. You can look at my live video for proof, because that's the very thing I don't do. I say that he used to talk like that.
Do you Michael Caine?
Okay. I say, Michael Caine used to talk like this in the 1960s, right? But that has changed. And I say that over the years, Michael's voice has come down several octaves. Let me finish. And all of the cigars and the brandy, don't let me finish, can now be heard.
Okay.
I've not fucking finished in the back of the voice. And the voice now. Well, I've still not finished the voice.
Because you're panicking.
Like you're about to bloody talk. Let me finish. Right, so Michael Caine's voice now in the Batman movies and in Harry Brown. I can't go fast because Michael Caine talks very, very slowly.
Right, this is how Michael Caine speaks. Michael Caine speaks to his nose like that. He gets very, very specific. It's very like that. When he gets loudly, it gets very loud indeed.
It gets very specific. It's not quite nasal enough the way you're doing it, all right? You're not doing it the way he speaks. You're not doing it with the kind of... And you don't do the broken voice, but he gets very emotional. But he gets very emotional indeed. She was only 16 years old. She was only 16. You're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off. That's Michael Caine.
So particularly in this trip to Greece, one of the reasons I had a certain softness for it is that, first off, I think I've traveled in Greece, unlike where I've been in the other movies they made, Spain, Northern England, and most of Italy. So I knew a lot of the spots in Greece. But besides that, they talk a lot about the Laura Hardy movie because Stephen Coogan had just been in it, sort of in the timing of the movie. So So that's really fun. Like Bryden's role in these movies is he's constantly taking down Stephen Coogan and making fun of him. And so he's constantly making fun of his role. And like they read movie reviews that afterwards I Googled and those movie reviews are real. So they read like scathing critics takes on Stephen Coogan talking about what talking like, you know, well, excellent in this movie, he's still such an ass. And then like they read those in the movie and discuss them. So the trip to Greece, strong rec, glad I already have Justin on board. It's a nice like mini series, so to speak, because, you know, they're saying this is the last one. I don't think it's going to be the last one, but...
They're going to do these forever. There's no way that they're not.
Quickly, some movies I saw that fit into that, you know, premature type, okay, but not amazing. Driveways, super conventional. It's about a fading old white man who befriends a young nerdy Asian boy. You can guess the entire plot from that summary, literally the entire part of the movie, you know, you now know. The movie is getting a lot of buzz because the old man is played by Brian Dennehy, a character actor.
Oh, yeah.
And he died the week before the movie came out. And I don't think, again, you know what's going to happen in this movie. Suffice to say, the old white man is not going to make it to the end. And so the fact that this was Brian Dennehy's last movie, it's not his last movie, but it's a movie that came out right after he died. And he's great in the movie. He's really good. The problem is no one else is great. So, you know, Driveways, it is what it is. If you like young, nerdy Asian boys who are finding themselves with Vietnam vets, then...
Why is it called Driveways?
They befriend each other sitting out in each other's driveways. So that's how they kind of... That's how they...
Oh, wow.
That's deep.
Something that I think is a bit more fun, I am calling it my best date movie of 2020. Excuse my French, because this is a French movie. It's called La Belle Époque. The super French, super sweet, super sappy version of Michael Douglas's The Game, which I love.
Oh, yes. You were talking about this.
So Michael Douglas's The Game is one of my favorite movies of all time.
It's incredible. I was just telling my wife that that's a Fincher movie that she definitely would like.
I love The Game. So this kind of has the basic plot contrivance, but, you know, set in France, of The Game, meaning someone enrolls in a program that is kind of enters into their life and makes everything around them fictional. And what they're essentially doing is it's about an old couple whose relationship in a very French way has fallen apart. And the old husband then enrolls in this production, which allows him to sort of meet, to go back to the 60s and to meet his wife again. And it's all like, you know, people pretending to be his wife and his friends in the 60s. And he kind of re-falls in love with his wife, et cetera, et cetera. It's a fun movie. It's just, again, it's super derivative. You know where it's going. I mean, it's very creative in that it has that kind of The Game-esque, you know, fake productions happening around his life. And that's the best part of the movie. It's amazing how they do it. Ultimately, this is a sappy romance. As Aaron was saying, there's a time and a place for that. You also, if you're like me, every 5 minutes you'll stop the movie and be like, this is so French. Like, look at his sweater. Look at the way they're talking over each other about philosophy, you know, and smoking cigarettes.
Is it as French as some Jean Renoir? Because I watched Jean Renoir earlier this week.
So. Oh, yep. Yeah, it is deeply, deeply French.
Everyone's just reading Tartuffe in the background. Oh, no, Tartuffe is it's Italian. I'm sorry. I'm a fake mid-century theater girl.
No,
I apologize, everyone.
Perfect, because I wanted to mention two movies in our recent watches, and they're both about the mafia, and they fit really in well together. The first one is actually set in Italy. It's in Italian. It was made by Italians, and that's its problem. And what it is, it's a true-to-life story about the first Italian mafia member in the late 1980s who famously revealed to the police the inner workings of the mob. He was the first person in history who divulged what the mafia actually is and how it functions. He's the reason that since the late 1980s, we now know stuff about the mob and all the movies that have resulted. The movie expects that you know what happened in the late 1980s in Italy super well. If you do not know about the way that the police and the mafia in Italy fought each other in the late 1980s and the mafia killed hundreds of people, etc., if you do not know the individual characters, You will have no idea what the hell is going on for the first hour of this movie. I had absolutely no idea who was who, where he was. Like, and so the best part of the movie, though, is the final third. A, because at that point you've caught up and you realize and you know your history. And, you know, also if you've been like me reading Wikipedia a bit, then you're fully informed. But also there are a few kind of beautifully shot classic scenes, and two of them I'll reference. Both of them I say classic, and they have like a lot of resonance with mafia movies. One of them is, so the best part of it is in the last part of the movie, the protagonist is an old retiree, an old mafia retiree who's hiding out in Florida, anxiously sitting out outside all night with a gun on his lap, reflecting on the sins of his past. And if that sounds like another movie about the mafia that I'm going to touch on in a second, then that, sir...
Married to the Mob.
That, sir, is why I watched The Traitor. I watched The Traitor because I just seen Capone, which I'll get to in a moment. So the very last third of The Traitor is Capone. It's the same idea, an old man, except without dementia. But that said, just the last part about The Traitor is that the main sin that he's reflecting on and having flashbacks while he's sitting out in Florida in his bathrobe with a AK-47 in The Traitor is this beautifully told, intermittently flashback scene about when he was a young up-and-coming mafiosa. And it's on the level of The Godfather Part II in those scenes, where he was a young up-and-coming mafiosa and he got a mission to kill his first person, James Bond style. He had to kill a young father. And effectively, and it's okay to tell this because, you know, it doesn't ruin anything of The Traitor. And this is the reason to watch The Traitor, I think, this like 5-minute scene cut into three parts, is early on in his career, he goes to kill the guy and the guy sees him and the guy grabs his 5-year-old son. And then he kind of keeps trying to come kill the guy over the course of the next 15 years. And the guy is always standing by his son to avoid being killed. And then finally, and it happens at the very end of the movie, his target that he's trying to kill is at the wedding of his son. And he celebrates with his son. He walks out of the church with his son. And then he kind of resigned to his fate. The elderly now father sits down in the empty church and waits for the protagonist to come knock him off. And that sort of memory of that sin, of that murder, is weighing on the protagonist the whole time. Do not watch The Traitor unless you first update yourself about what the hell was going on in the late 1980s with the mafia, because it's incredibly powerful if you really know what's going on, and otherwise it's kind of a miss. Finally, Capone. Mm-hmm. Bum, 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 bum.
Truly jealous that you guys have seen
Capone. I was sure Capone was going to be the movie of May 2020. Tom Hardy playing Al Capone. So much there. So much that seemed to be set up for success. And the hate is incredible for this movie. And I think the hate is unfounded. And the reason is the following. People are saying, like, what the hell is going on? Why is Tom Hardy wearing tons of makeup, muttering to himself, crapping himself, and, like, you know, dealing with his past demons as an old retiree Al Capone in a bathrobe with a gun on his lap sitting in Florida, aka The Traitor? Mainly what they're getting at is Al Capone in Capone, Tom Hardy's character, has incredible dementia. And the movie is all framed as taking a trip through the uncanny valley of his mind. And once you embrace that, the movie as a whole is trying to give the viewer the same experience that Al Capone is sort of, so to speak, having, there's a lot there to admire. And the structure of the movie, I think there's a lot there to admire. And I usually don't reference critics too much, you know, kind of in line with what Aaron said at the top. There was so much hate for this movie, I think it's kind of impossible to ignore. And therefore, again, it falls into my things I liked, but still have problems with it, because there are way too many strands that the movie never follows up on in a way that it should. I mean, there's a whole strand about, there's a doctor character who's supposed to be trying to forced by the FBI to find out where is Al Capone's hidden treasure, buried gold.
Yeah, I didn't expect this to be so surreal. It's bold. It goes for it better than Fantastic Four. So
well, I mean, that's not precisely I could give that high of a bar.
I think it had all warrants to Gotti comparisons that have been coming for it.
There's like a certain arrogance to Gotti, right? Like, it's taking itself so seriously and it doesn't realize that it's like insane, while Capone seems to completely embrace the fact that it's insane and then runs with it.
Capone embraces it's insane. It embraces that as it's very surreal. The flashback scenes are pretty good. I mean, people were saying, oh, I wish we could have just had a Tom Hardy movie where he was playing young Al Capone in, you know, in 1930s Chicago. But there's a surreal scene towards the end. Al Capone kind of goes on a murdering spree in his as an old retiree in Florida, but it's kind of all happening in his mind. Everything in this movie is kind of happening in his mind. There's a lot there that's fun. And like, if you just embrace the movie for what it is, if you're a Tom Hardy fan, it's kind of like what Justin was saying, McConaughey and others and Guy Ritchie. If you're a Tom Hardy fan, if you find him enjoyable, then this is certainly a movie you should see, even if it's not a great
movie. That guy is so fascinating to me, just like as a quote unquote leading man and how like willing he is to do broad stuff. I'm so excited to see Capone. I'm glad you guys liked it.
Two movies I absolutely hated that people should definitely avoid. The first is Arkansas. If you want to see a Hemsworth Malkovich small town murder mystery, see 2014's Cut Bank. Because Cut Bank is more fun. And Arkansas, it was a good effort. The director plays the co-star. I think him and Malkovich are the best part of the movie. I just don't think Hemsworth can carry the movie. And the movie, you know, again, it just leaves too many things. You can tell it's a first movie, or even maybe it shouldn't have been a first movie just yet.
Let me jump to Arkansas's defense a little bit. You're not bringing up the best part of the movie, Vince Vaughn. Clark Duke shouldn't have focused so much on his own character.
This is his directorial debut, correct?
Yeah, and he's also starring in the movie alongside...
I like his character. I find his character...
I do too, but I liked Vince Vaughn's character more.
To me, Vince Vaughn is being Vince Vaughn. He's Vince Vaughn. No?
I think the flashbacks, he's playing a little bit of a different role than usual. I think maybe in the present day, he was kind of playing Vince Vaughn when he was in the... And John Malkovich was really wasted in this movie, which is always a crime.
Malkovich is always incredible, but you're right. He was wasted. I kept on thinking they're going to do more with him. And like,
I can't believe how little they did with... He must have been on the set for half a day.
He's in such a weird pocket now, too. Like, he's very funny in Space Force, but the entire time that I'm watching Space Force, I'm just like, how the hell did they get John Malkovich to be in a... sitcom about the Space Force, and why is he so good at it? Like, it's very weird.
So Aaron, what would your pick be between Cut Bank and Arkansas? Because I think they're similar.
Cut Bank is A24. It's an early A24, I believe. I'm an A24 fiend.
Isn't it weird that Hemsworth and Malkovich did another small town Coen Brothers-esque murder mystery? Why?
Maybe that's why Malkovich came back, because Hemsworth was like, give me another chance. I'm going to actually be good this time. Because I actually thought Hemsworth, this is the best Hemsworth has been to me in a role that I've seen.
Yeah.
Which isn't saying much again.
He doesn't do much for me. Skip Arkansas, again, unless that's your jam hardcore, you're like a Vince Vaughn all over it.
The Imitation Coen has Imitation Coens get. Another thing I really can't stand about movies when they're focusing on a local or regional aspect is when all the accents are different.
Yeah.
None of them match the area.
None of them.
So let me give some pure hate then, and I'm not even going to share what the plot of this is, because I don't even want people to know, because I hate this movie so much. Worst movie of the year so far for me. Spaceship Earth came out at the beginning of May. I absolutely hated this. I'm only mentioning it to make sure no one else wastes their time, and I think what's like a 2-hour documentary. This documentary abandons a critical lens worse than The Last Dance, which is saying something. It completely just spoon feeds us these incredibly like dim-witted and boring and like frankly ripe for sharp critique. The people who, you know, are the main figures in Spaceship Earth. You can Wikipedia it, you know. Again, it's one of those documentaries, just Wikipedia it, and it'll be more scintillating. It's also just a poorly shot movie, a poorly told documentary. Complete miss. But instead of Spaceship Earth, if you do want a movie about a spaceship set in small town southern United States of America, that is what brings us to The Vast of Night.
What a segue.
I know.
Yeah, I told you, it's an all-timer of an episode. Say I'm a horror guy, we're talking about porno, and we're doing good transitions.
Hey, Edward, it's Faye. A sound came through the board and interrupted your radio show.
What sound?
What's going on, Everett?
We got a low-budget 1950s UFO drama about two teenagers exploring possible paranormal activity. We'll save spoilers so listeners know to the end of our discussion here, so listeners can press ahead even if they have not seen The Vast of Night, and then we'll just do a quick spoiler session. Justin, come at me. On a scale of yes to yes, sir, how much did you like this movie and why?
It's got to be a yes, sir, for me. It's just like you... For a debut movie, comes at you so quickly and so fully formed with its own voice, its own tone, its own charms, its own like little ecosystem that it never really tells you completely everything you need to know about, but it gives you everything that you like want to know just to like get behind the characters. I was really blown away by it, and I wasn't expecting it to be this good, and I wasn't expecting it to be this charming, and I wasn't expecting it to be like nearly this engaging.
I wasn't even thinking the fact that such a Justin-esque movie could be our feature.
And it really, it kind of is.
And when the
totally honest.
And when the stars aligned, I was super excited. To me, what's so fascinating is that this movie seems like it's just going to be a homage. It's just going to be a homage.
It's just going to be a retread
of a genre first kind of safe feature. And yet it's so distinct. My favorite scene, and it's one of my favorite scenes of the year, is the phone conversation in the middle. And not to sort of give, you know, the best podcast episode of the year too much credit, but like maybe as someone who kind of enjoys the podcast medium, there is something powerful about watching two people essentially sort of listen to someone on audio. And yet the way he puts that scene and captures it and films it, and you know, there's this kind of running element in the movie. The movie's set as if you're watching a TV episode.
Paradox, it's paradox theater in the realm of the TV show.
Yeah, it's like a Twilight Zone.
Or the movie, yeah. It's very much an Outer Limits, Twilight Zone-y kind of thing.
And so there's a thing where like at certain points, the camera, and they probably also did this conceit because maybe they didn't have like the most expensive, it's a very, very low budget movie. There's certain points where like the camera quality, like the film quality is sort of faded a bit. And then during that long phone conversation and also later in the movie, the screen goes black several times. And it works so well for me because it really draws you into the conversation, and you go from looking at the faces of the two incredible young leads. I think they do a really good job acting, the two leads. But then that phone conversation, again, I've never quite seen anything like that in a movie. I've never seen a movie try that before, and it worked really, really well. My breath was on the edge of my mouth in terms of listening to that veteran call into the radio to share that eerie paranormal experience he had with strong racial overtones.
The sound we heard out in the desert, it was coming from thousands of feet higher than anything could fly.
You were just to read the script, it's not, frankly, what he's saying is not like that super compelling, but that's good filmmaking. And you know, the way it's filmed and sounded and set and everything else, that scene in the movie as a whole, I think there's just so much special that's being done there.
Didn't love it as much as you two. The direction, the atmosphere really felt like it was a character through this movie. I really
absolutely
that. Like it felt like there was like a spirit over the whole movie, and that was just like really, really cool and really effective directing from Patterson. I feel like we're going to see the two leads in another movie down the line together. They were so good together. Jake Horowitz, I was just really impressed by Sarah McCormick as well.
From the opening bit, like you get both of their dynamics very, very quickly.
When another character with like a trombone is introduced for like a split sec, like everything fits. Like nothing, everything is sort of unnecessary.
About the trombone is the best.
The whole opening scene, none of it really matters in terms of pushing the plot as such forward. The mystery of the movie doesn't really matter so much. And that's, in essence, that's the plot. The plot is the mystery.
I think it being so episodic is kind of a double-edged sword. We talked a little bit about this. A spoiler alert. We talk off mic. We're friends. Jealous. Having this being such a successful Twilight Zone riff in the wake of a not really successful actual Twilight Zone reboot is kind of morbidly charming to me, I guess. It's just like seeing it make such good use of 50 science fiction kitschiness. So often you see people aping different people's styles, and it sounds like such a bad cover. But this, it's goes down like a particularly good cover of like a Twilight Zone or an Amazing Stories or something. There's a tactility to it too, I think, that it sets it apart from other stuff. The focus on the old technology and like you were saying, Sam, like there's so much focus on like phones and switchboards and old fuses and like all of this old like lo-fi technology that I think gives it a pop that it probably didn't have on the page itself.
I guess I didn't need the framing device of the Paradox Theater.
Many of the streaming movies we've received with theaters closed down for the last few months, there's a sense that, you know, they're not fully a movie. They could have been a TV pilot. They could have been a limited series. Okay. Coen Brothers-esque Blow the Man Down, which came out last month and I loved. Okay. We discussed that in the last pod, and like Av, my co-host, had said, you know, he wasn't fully on board with Blow the Man Down because he felt like it was a TV pilot for a really good TV series, but still, he didn't really feel it was movie enough. And yet, so given this movie is framed as a TV show, do you think it falls into that same trap?
A little bit of a first director syndrome, maybe. I thought that framing device, I think we still would have came to the conclusion this was a 1950s Rod Sterling, you know, homage to, just like we were able to get the Orson Welles references with the radio, you know, in War of the World.
It's a little gilding the lily, I think.
Just a slightly bit. It had heart, which I never am going to hate.
I appreciate it being such a loving touch instead of it being like, isn't this crazy that people used to think this is entertainment, which is so much the gag and a lot of that stuff.
Unlike some other movies so far, particularly during the corona, you know, straight to streaming, this was the most movie of almost any movie I've seen this year, except for Wild Goose Lake and Baccarat. This was cinematic to the core. And, you know, I've seen things where people have said like, hey, if you can check out The Vast of Night on drive-in, that's kind of the epic way to watch this movie. And not so much for like the 1950s-esque, you know, drive-in experience, but because this is a big screen experience. The sound, the setting, you know, the grainy, at times even black screen, you know, imagine at a drive-in sort of when the whole screen goes black at some point, like that'd probably be epic. You know, the camera, the way it creates that mood that Aaron was speaking about, it was the most movie I felt in watching something so far this year. And that's so incredible given that it's on a nothing budget. I mean, the director paid for the movie himself. He says like he owns 100% of it. My impression of a movie should not be set by the budget and the backstory and whatnot.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I don't want to know whether a movie judge it if it cost 100 million or if it cost 10 million. You know, it's ultimately what you put on the page or the screen. There's a big bravura tracking shot divides the first arc and the second arc. And it's being celebrated a lot. I think the director said the way they filmed it is that they had a boy on a go-kart just with a camera attached drive through the town. It's a small town in Texas, and that's how they filmed it. To my mind, camera choices should always be driven by narrative. And I wasn't quite sure at all, and I still am not right now. What was the purpose of that tracking shot?
That's first director syndrome.
Yeah, I was literally about to say this is what Aaron was talking about earlier. It's the bad side of this coin.
Let me show all the aspects.
There's kind of a mini tracking shot in the very opening. It's establishing the geography of the gym.
10 minutes into the movie, I thought in my head, this movie's going to have an epic tracking shot. I really did. Not to sound cynical.
There's an entire generation of directors that saw that True Detective episode, and they're like, yeah, I'm doing this.
I think I wrote on my Letterboxd review, because I always try to keep those really short and non-spoilery, David Fincher does 1950s Twilight Zone, which is decent praise.
Absolutely. That's a pretty good elevator pitch. Like,
absolutely. Like, that's not bad. And so, it seems like what it was. If you take out that tracking shot in the framing device at the beginning, my opinion, this movie doesn't go down.
2 minutes of open spoilers. People can jump ahead 2 minutes if they want. Were you guys okay with the ending, or were you disappointed? To the extent it was a mystery, did you want there to be a bit more there? I'll go first to say, I liked where the old grandma was going and how they were sort of dismissive of her. And I was kind of hoping it was going to be a little bit more complex and a little bit less of that kind of just straight up homage, like goodbye. I would have liked it to, so to speak, have not been the Soviets, but you know what I mean? Like to have been something, so to speak, real.
Within the first like 10 to 15 minutes of you kind of get the dance, once that ball's in the air, you know you got to catch it at some point. You know what I mean?
I didn't need to see like alien ship. I didn't need to ever see like the shark, I guess. That's what the cool kids say.
That's how I usually feel about movies, is I don't need to see the shark.
Yeah. Like even if the shark's going to eat them up as they get eaten up in the ending.
See it.
Yeah, they get eaten up at the ending, so to speak. Like, I don't need to even have seen the shark before it eats them. It could have just been...
When you compare it to, like, the first feature of Clark Duke.
Yeah.
Arkansas had a great tracking shot, too, Sam, that you didn't bring up.
Andre Patterson, the director of The Vast of Night, talk about the actors in the movie are going to go on to do things, but he is going to be going on to do big things. I mean, this is... Great. this is the kind of first movie which in today's day and age immediately leads to a massive
absolutely.
A massive MCU Thor Ragnarok type follow-up.
Oh yeah, this guy is going to be announced to do, he's going to do the Midnight Suns movie or something where he's going to like reboot Ghost Rider. I was frankly kind of worried towards the middle that I was like, oh, they're really probably going to try to shoehorn some sort of romance into this. But like, yeah. I was very pleased that they kept it not only chaste, respectful.
So maybe that's why Aaron doesn't like go for it.
not enough romance in this.
Yeah.
I'm starting to realize, man, I'm very genre driven, apparently.
You can have a romantic multiple bones to not make it too erotic in your body. And Justin and I celebrate that. We'll close out The Vast of Night by giving a shout out to Amazon Studios, which is where you can find this movie. They have reeled off in the last 2-3 months. I think they're dominating the summer, you know, this weird summer as far as movies go, which is they've reeled off The Vast of Night, Bad Education, and The Assistant, which I think are the three best streaming movies that I've seen so far this year. Kudos to Amazon's selection, because I think they're knocking it out of the park.
I agree.
Captain Hindsight, thank God you've come!
What's the skinny?
There's people trapped in that burning building, Captain Hindsight, and the fire is so massive we can't get to them!
You see those windows on the right side? They should have built fire escapes on those windows for the higher floors, then people could have gotten down. And then on the roof, they should have built it with a more reinforced structure so a helicopter could have landed on it. Yes, of course! Well, looks like my job here is done. Goodbye, everyone!
Hindsight. It's easy to know the right thing to do after something has happened, but it's hard to predict the future. That's the definition I saw for what is hindsight. If there was ever a phrase I think perfect for a movie list, especially given the craziness that is 2020, I think it would be hindsight. With that in mind, I've invited Justin and Aaron to tell us their top three best movies ever about the theme of hindsight, however they wish to define that, and they can change that definition from movie to movie. And so each of them will make the case to me why their selection is a great movie about hindsight. Any genre is open to their interpretation. Justin, do you want to start us off with your number three? What is it and why is it the third best movie ever made about hindsight?
An often overlooked of Rian Johnson's canon, which is The Brothers Bloom, his kind of screwball take on con men and romantic comedies of the 40s and 50s. Big security blanket movie for me, but just because the brothers' relationship is so rooted in how they were before. Mark Ruffalo's character is constantly trying to get Adrian Brody back to where the trio was before he became disillusioned with cons and kind of disillusioned with crime.
Why is this a classic hindsight film?
How much Mark Ruffalo's character wants to get back to that moment, but in doing so, realizes that it's not as important as he thinks that it is. He's not living for his brother in the now, and he can't even see that he's trying to move on with his own life. He's dragging him down with what he wants before. I'm not a lawyer. I'm just a simple caveman. But I believe that The Brothers Bloom is the third best movie about hindsight.
Aaron, what do you got for us?
Brothers Bloom is a fantastic movie. I got to watch that recently. It's very, very good. In hindsight, so good. I wish I had seen it sooner. Good choice there.
Well played.
I was warned about Justin before this show that he's
a little bit
out there with his picks and everything. So I wanted to go nice and basic for my first pick. When I thought of hindsight, it's not only hindsight for the characters in the movie, it's hindsight for the audience. And that would be M. Night Shyamalan's The Sixth Sense.
This is great.
Bruce Willis should have kind of seen he was dead, like at the awkward dinner conversation. He must have had a really shitty relationship with
literally
everybody.
No one is making eye contact with him.
And like, like this drink isn't going anywhere. You can't open doors. There's all sorts of hindsight here, which 2020, even the afterlife. And the audience should have been like, oh man, I should have saw that too. So I'll keep it short for my first one, but Sixth Sense, maybe the best hindsight movie of all time, but I'll keep it at my number three.
My vote's going to go to Aaron on this one. And
potentially
the reason was I just felt Justin left a good argument in the water there. He was going at a famous brother and nominating a brothers movie. And I think you could have taken apart the Brooks Brothers with your Brothers Bloom.
Which we did on another one of Zach's podcasts, The Movie Ladder. We covered that, and I was on that episode.
You had a brother angle there. You could have really pressed that, a sensitive point, Justin, but you went easy on him, so don't go easy anymore.
Okay, my number two, I'm going to be talking about the Coen brothers tier. I had a couple different spots I was going on this one. I actually went with their funniest movie to me is Burn After Reading.
Absolutely.
Living in Washington, D.C., my views on the government have become a little bit comical at this point in 5 years. I originally moved here to work a federal government job that I quit very soon after moving here. But
why? No, I'm kidding. I know precisely why.
It's just like the movies. At the end of the movie, spoiler alert for Burn After Reading, J.K. Simmons is sitting there after a bunch of people have died just talking. And they're like, what did we learn? I don't know. I guess we'll never do that again. That's like, the whole movie. And that pissed so many people off. People were like, oh, what a stupid ending. Loved the ending.
The hardest I've ever laughed in a movie theater is probably Burn After Reading.
The look on Brad Pitt's face when George Clooney opens it, he realizes he should have just been nice, but hindsight's 20/20, gets a bullet in the head. If you're ever hiding in the, shouldn't have hidden in the closet. At the end of the movie, if you looked at any of the characters and asked what they learned from the woman at the gym who wanted the plastic surgery, they all would have said the same thing. I guess we'll never do that again. Like, it would have been all their answers.
Such a beautiful note of just, God.
Yeah. Justin, you're doing a good job competing against me here.
Come on, Justin. Take him down. Take him down, Justin.
When you're throwing... When you're throwing heat like this, I can't swing at it. I want to get invited back. I mean, honestly, at this point, I have to cede it to you. My second is a little bit a more obvious pick, hindsight. Rashomon by Akira Kurosawa. The entire film is hindsight. One event that you get their side, the other side, and the truth. It's a perfect, moralistic, entertaining fable. It also speaks to like the need of hindsight, the need of introspection, and the need of examining yourself. I'm a Philistine, but Jesus Christ. It was the first Akira Kurosawa movie I ever saw, and it's the one that burned into my brain kind of the most, I feel like, just in terms of how it affected me as a person and how it affected me as an artist.
I'm going to give the gavel to Justin here, and it's for one thing. He's one argument he said in particular, and that was Jesus Christ. I think invoking Jesus really brought home to me the hindsight-esque-ness of your argument, because if there's ever a figure who you could say embodies hindsight, it would be, you know, the Lord's Son, depending upon the day of his, you know, return or whatnot. We got a tie going into the finals. Number three went to Aaron. Number two went to Justin. Justin, maybe as the most recent winner, do you want to go first or second here?
I have to just get off my chest.
Okay, so Justin, take it away.
Schenectady, New York by Charlie Kaufman.
What a pick.
Literally another movie that is predicated on the premise of hindsight. Philip Seymour Hoffman's character wants so badly to live his life correctly that he forgets to live it, and in trying to build it alienates everyone around him and forgets to be a person.
I've been following you for 20 years, so I knew about this audition because I follow you, and I learned everything about you by following you. So hire me and you'll see who you truly are. Hazel, I don't think we need to talk to anyone else. This guy has me down. I'm going to cast him right now. And then maybe you and I can get a drink. And we can try to figure out this thing between us. Why I cried. Because I've never felt about anybody the way I feel about you. And I want to fuck you until we merge into a chimera. A mythical beast with penis and vagina eternally fused. Two pairs of eyes that look only at each other. And lips never touching. Yeah, one voice that whispers to itself.
Okay. You've got the part.
It's devastating. I don't think I've ever not sobbed embarrassingly loud while watching this movie, especially to kind of people our age or to people in our age brackets that kind of get so caught up in the minutiae of their personality and their reality that they build up these walls around themselves that they can't connect with, even though they try desperately to. That could just be me projecting because I don't have a lot of friends, but I feel like it's a good argument. I'm going to leave now, you guys. Do you guys just finish out with it?
Quietly walk out the door. That was a powerful number one. But Aaron, he has left you for your closings.
I love that movie, by the way.
It's so hard to watch, but it's so good.
Hindsight, it didn't come to my mind even for like my list. So I'm glad you didn't take my number one, which it's not a super obvious number one maybe to a lot of people. But it's a movie that I've seen for the first time this month. I've seen it 3 times this month.
Wow.
And it does have a very, very, very key plot point that has to do with hindsight, and that is Wong Kar-wai's Chungking Express.
Oh, man, that's so good.
Dude, if you haven't seen this movie, download your free trial of the Criterion Channel or find a way to watch it off your porno stream account, you know, whatever.
Hey, don't blow up my spot, Aaron. How dare you?
Wong Kar-wai does romance in a way that pulls my entire heart out. He is a beautiful, beautiful filmmaker. This movie, you follow around the original Manny Pixie Dream Girl, Faye. Basically, it's about two police officers who are madly in love and have their relationships fall apart. So there's the hindsight of realizing you've committed yourself to someone and abandoned huge aspects of yourself along the way. So similar to half of it, but done way better here. Also, in the movie, Faye becomes obsessed with one of the police officers, starts sneaking into his apartment and cleaning his apartment and like replacing like his worn down soap because he had gotten all depressed and let his apartment go to hell after his last relationship. Yet he doesn't notice like his soap has gone from that tiny thin bar to like a brand new soap. All these things that in hindsight, you should probably realize and then he catches her cleaning his apartment at one point and realizes, oh, you've been doing this. But like, he's talking to his soap and he's like, oh, you've gained weight. You're coming back. You're feeling better. You shouldn't be feeling better yet. Like, just, it's all sorts of weird existential romance, just right up my romantic heart. The hindsight is all over the place there, both, it's, you know, existentially and with, oh, I should have known someone was cleaning my apartment. I wasn't making my bed every day.
It's such an intimate thing too. Like, it's such a personal, intimate, like, oh God. It's so good.
Wong Kar-wai became one of my favorite directors overnight. I love him. And this movie is fantastic.
Besides, obviously, just the fun, the silly, you know, hindsight is 20/20. The concept of hindsight, find it in many different ways. You know, it can be about memory. It can be about understanding something only after the fact. It can be about sort of seeing the future somehow, in a sense, you know, learning from the past. I think there's a lot of horror genre, which might be very hindsight. There's a lot of romance, which can be very hindsight. You know, drama, obviously. So it's there's really a lot there. I was just happy that neither of you guys came at me with like Daredevil, Ray, or The Miracle Worker. You know, a movie
about
someone who doesn't have 20, maybe The Book of Ellie, you know, a movie about someone who doesn't actually have 20/20 vision. Yeah, and then you're like, aha. But nevertheless.
I mean, that's a good gag, Sam. I should have noticed that.
Oh, man. You're number four. You're number four and you're number five. I'm going to lead listeners, we'll put it up online, to vote on who's number one they find more compelling. Again, not the better movie, but the better resonance, which however you associate with the concept of hindsight in the movies.
One last thing about the Chungking Express. There's a huge plot point with expired cans of pineapple, which he eats at the end of the month. Probably has some hindsight about that too. Just saying.
This is the ultimate game of like film Uno. You throw down Wong Kar-wai, and I just have to stare at it and just pick up an entire deck of cards. Zodiac was almost my number one for like a hot second. Entirely built around obsession and not introspection, but just kind of like memory and stuff like that.
And not to help you out, Justin, but the audience has quite a bit of hindsight, I think, watching a lot of Philip Seymour Hoffman late performances.
Absolutely.
So the amount that adds to, I hate to make that argument, but it adds a layer.
Before the Devil Knows You're Dead was on cable the other day, and I caught it right in the middle of it. And I was like, God, now knowing what we know, this is even more of a heartbreaking, incredible performance.
I think it does really take Synecdoche to the next level, though. Mm-hmm. I hate to say it.
We'll leave this one set aside. Schenectady, New York, Chungking Express. Great choices. Both of them have a city and then another word. So that's my Sammy Chester insight for our choices. You know, clearly those are
You should double feature those two, listeners. Oh, if you double feature, God, those, you have no tear ducts.
Oh, man, that is a day.
Yeah. Let's kind of, before we sign off, quickly share a classic in our classics corner. Something we saw over the last 30 plus days that did not come out in 2020. However you define a classic. Og can go first. For me, I was deeply into The Trip. So, of course, after seeing all four Trip movies, I went back and saw the 2005 comedy A Cock and Bull Story, which is what started it all.
Oh, Tristram Shandy!
Yes. So this is Michael Winterbottom, the director of the Trip movies. He directed, again, a movie within a movie where Stephen Coogan and Rob Brydon play themselves making a movie. It's a straight up comedy. It's super fun. It's super well made. I consider it a Trip movie. I would say it's the precursor to the four Trip movies, which is why I think there's five of them so far. And this is the most watchable of all of them. So I would actually say, if you want to get into the Trip movies, first see The Cock and Bull Story, as opposed to myself who saw it last. And then, you know, chronologically, you can continue on to the Trips. So Cock and Bull Story, 2005, that's my classic.
I believe it was the first week of the new season of Shudder's The Last Drive-In, Joe Bob Briggs, they showed Bill Lustig's Maniac from 1980. It had been a really long time since I'd seen Maniac. The main thing was that they had Tom Savini as the guest on that episode. I kind of forgot that it's like a giant cornerstone of the sleazy New York dramas of the 1980s. I mean, it's obviously a horror movie, and it's obviously a kind of a proto-slasher, but like, I genuinely forgotten how much kind of Scorsesean visual language is, and like, it's very Bad Lieutenant in some fashions. I was very impressed with it, just beyond the gory drive-in thrills, quote-unquote, that I usually get out of horror movies. I kind of feel like that's an early one that has a little bit more going on beyond the titillation of it. It's a little smarter than I think people give it credit for, and plus it has probably the greatest exploding head gag of any movie besides Scanners. It's up on Shudder right now. They have just the film version, or you can watch the Last Drive-In episode, which I highly recommend.
So if Justin didn't get you with the blood showers in porno, he's gonna come through with the scalped heads in Maniac.
One squib at a time. I'm gonna get you guys into horror by hook or by crook.
Gotta stay with my boy Wong here. There's just only one suggestion after Chungking Express, and that is 1995's Fallen Angels, a perfect companion piece to Chungking Express, not quite as beloved or known. I loved it more. I thought it was darker, a little seedier, a little more raw, and just as emotional. Honestly, the last 15 minutes may be my favorite 15 minutes in a film that I've ever seen. Wow. It is incredibly moving to me. There's some specific aspects to him losing his father in the movie that are always going to be a tenet for me as someone who lost their father at an early age. Brief moment of emotional intimacy for the main character, her being very aware it's going to end, and just it wrecks me every time. The music, song called Only You that I have listened to like every day since then. It is just it's such a moving movie, and it goes so well with Chungking Express. So I think you can watch it without it, but I would suggest those two together. He wrote both of them back to back, and he wrote most of them on the set.
I didn't see either one of your classics, which is what I love. So I'll take up, I might take up Aaron first, Justin, because I'm not fully on board yet, horror, as I said. But yeah, I've always...
No! What?
I know. Can you believe I'm going to go for Fallen Angels over Maniac?
Genius auteur over Bill Lustig.
To be fair, I would have gone for the endless classic, which is Angel Has Fallen, the 2019...
Oh, Jesus, the head stab, the movie.
So I would have gone for most iterations of the word angel and fallen.
I've been acting like I discovered this guy and recommending him. People are like, yeah, I've heard of Wong Kar-wai.
For like decades.
Did you know about this guy? He's incredible.
Thanks you guys so much for joining.
Aaron, awesome to meet you.
Hopefully lived up to being Zach's little brother.
No idea you were a younger brother. He mentioned my brother Aaron, and you know, in my mind,
oh,
it was always like...
You didn't say my little brother. How nice of that.
You know, there isn't like a sequel to My Brother Sam Is Dead.
Yeah. It won't take long. I'm gonna stand up here and sing my song. I wanna dedicate it to my friends from the very beginning to the end. I'm not a hostage to regret, but so many times I can't forget. If I could get back to those days, I know what to do. I know.